So tonight, we're going to begin exploring the steps of recovery for the hurt spouse. Leslie will be helping with all of this. So John, would you like to begin us tonight?
Yeah, tonight, kind of like Rick mentioned in our lead-in, we're going to be talking about the four R's in the betrayed spouse's recovery.
But before we go into the four R's, John's going to start us off this evening by reading a poem written by one of our clients, a betrayed wife, who's a few years down the road from this place. But the poem really describes very well what it's like to be going through this.
You sleep as though nothing is wrong. The neighbors still say hi. The laundry still piles up. The baby still cries. Don't they know? Don't they know? My world fell apart. The girls still come to stay. The family still calls to chat. The boys still want to play. Can't they see? Can't they see I have a broken heart? How can the world still be normal when my world was blown apart? How can things be sane again? How can I trust you? Trust me? How do I even start? How could I not know? How could you hide so long? How could I think we were partners, lovers, friends? We love you and appreciate you, need you and miss you. How could you do this to me, to us, to our family? How could we mean so little that you would spend and waste your time, money, and energy? Now everything I see is tainted. Our happy pictures tarnished, our happy home fragile and stressed, our memories together clouded with doubt, and our sacred vows are shattered. A deception so deep, so devious and dark, a betrayal so complete, an abuse so intimately cutting, I am left totally weak. Can't they see? My world's ripped apart. Don't they know? Don't they know? I have a broken heart.
For those of you who have been betrayed by infidelity in the marriage, these words may even be bringing tears to your eyes, because the recovery that you're going through is difficult, painful. It's something that you didn't choose. You didn't sign up for it. We are going to go into the four R's of your recovery tonight. But before we do, just want to give you a little bit about what usually happens to a betrayed spouse after they've discovered the infidelity. A lot of times they will seek out help and professionals, and they'll go see counselors, and the counselors will actually try to fix the marriage, or they'll try to deal with the person who's been unfaithful. And a lot of times for you, the betrayed spouse, your recovery is overlooked, and sometimes your pain is glossed over. And a lot of well-meaning people who are trying to help will often try to deal with the marriage without dealing with the pain of the infidelity. And couples will go forward crippled, because unless you all are able to deal with your pain, it's difficult to go on. Recovery we're going to talk about tonight talks about tasks. A lot of times people talk about stages or phases, but I think it's very important for you all to look at your recovery proactively and be involved and realize that there are actually things that you can do, regardless of what your spouse does or doesn't do, to help yourself. There exists a widespread myth in our society that a happily married person will not be unfaithful, but if you've been to our website or listened to a previous show, only one of the different types of the five affairs are connected to an unhappy marriage. And so a lot of times the marriage is fixed, but the betrayal itself is not dealt with. And I think that's a really critical piece of your recovery. So the first task is the task of realization. A lot of times when I'll have a couple come in, or even just the betrayed spouse come in, they seem like they're doing really, really well. And they'll tell me that they've already forgiven their spouse, that they see God at the center of this, and that they know God will bring something good out of it. And although those things are probably all true and very good, chances are good that the person is still in shock. A lot of times when we go to funerals, we'll look at the family and we'll go, wow, they're really strong. They're handling this really well. But the truth is, they're still in shock. And depending on what your spouse has done, it may take a while before you can actually get your head around what you're forgiving them for. But until you can really grasp what they've done, you can't really experience the feeling. And in the beginning, the numbness and the shock are kind of a nice gift from God. But eventually, it will wear off and the feelings will come.
One of the things I think that's important about this stage is that I think some people don't want to necessarily hear the story. Would you agree with that, Leslie?
Yeah, we do have some people who've been pretty good little ostriches.
And so what's the problem with being an ostrich?
Well, the problem with being an ostrich is it's really hard to forgive something if you don't even know what it is. And the other person never has the chance to be known and forgiven.
Yeah, I think that as we deal with couples who have been rotating around some sort of a recovery process for maybe 16 or 17 years, which some of you may go, surely people don't struggle with this for that long, but absolutely they can struggle with it for that long, and it's really, I think, one of the most tragic things that we witness. And a lot of it comes down to this first stage where, for whatever reason, either the unfaithful spouse or the hurt spouse really hasn't been able to go through this stage and hasn't been willing to really look and understand. They do need to know the story so that they can begin to let God transform the loss that they're experiencing, just kind of put it before God and begin to deal with this situation.
Because denial only lasts for a certain period of time. It will pop its ugly head.
Yeah, and I would add, it's not unusual for the betrayed partner to have a pretty wide-ranging set of emotions that come with this. They can sometimes feel like they're stupid because they were deceived, or they don't know how that happened, that they're crazy because somehow they didn't trust their instinct, or that just the whole thing feels like a bad dream.
Right, and the other thing is this stage, and I don't know if we mentioned timeline, but this stage doesn't necessarily, I believe, get over in necessarily 1 week.
Well, yeah, and as I mentioned a little bit earlier, if you're married to somebody with a sexual addiction and they've been with hundreds of other people, it's going to really take a while for a person to get their head around that.
We normally discover, I think, or find that most people will take as long as maybe 6 weeks to actually get the story out. And it's oftentimes more of an eking sort of situation where this stage is really quite painful because it's not something that we have the good fortune of necessarily happening very quickly.
And I guess we should go to break.
You bet. So let's continue with our discussion about the four R's.
Yeah, and before we roll into task two, I'm going to let Leslie tie up the last part of task one, which was realization, and she's going to summarize kind of the main goals that need to be accomplished.
And the main goals in this task are, first of all, confrontation must occur. As Rick was talking about earlier, you can't be an ostrich. Sometimes you may have had an idea that something was wrong and you ignored your instincts and just kept feeling like it would go away, but it's not going to. And so the truth really has to be addressed. The infidelity can't be ignored, rationalized, or minimized. And most importantly, support for the betrayed needs to be sought out.
So with that, let's go ahead and roll into task two, which is reaction.
This is a difficult stage. did you want to say something, Rick?
Oh, my favorite stage.
This is the one that the unfaithful spouse really has some trouble with, too. But just like normal grieving, a person in normal grieving has to work through the pain of the loss, the feelings that go with it. That's true in your own recovery from infidelity, because in a lot of ways, your recovery is much like that of a person going through normal grieving. But the problem is you have the additional challenge of the stigma of having been betrayed. A lot of times, you know, people will blame you, or you feel blamed, and you feel like you carry the shame of what they did. But the normal feelings in grieving or recovering from infidelity are guilt, pain, isolation, fear, guilt, loneliness, and anger. And even in normal grieving, a lot of people try to go around their feelings. And we try in this, in the United States, we try to do grieving really fast. And you just can't go around the feelings of it. Seen some people try to go around the feelings, and then a year later, they're really, really upset. And a year later, it's just a more difficult time for your unfaithful spouse to deal with your feelings.
So the steps of grieving, is that the same thing as like Kubler-Ross and what she teaches in stages of grief? Or do you remember what her stages of grief were?
Well, I think there's some similarities to them.
Yeah, and a lot of research recently has shown that, Kubler-Ross's original stages aren't necessarily linear, meaning that they don't necessarily occur in any order, that someone can sort of jump around from one to another.
So, I mean, someone could actually kind of be at the maybe bargaining stage and then go back up toward denial?
Absolutely.
And not necessarily just stay in bargaining? Or
right. And that is a point that I really want to emphasize with your recovery is, you know, the first few weeks, the first month, or the first few months, you may go back and forth between these two tasks. You may feel like everything's okay, and then a wave of pain will hit you, and you feel knocked back, and that's just normal. But it's very disorienting.
Yeah, and the denial thing, like Leslie says, can be huge. I mean, we live in kind of a pain avoidance society where people kind of have a tendency to turn away from their pain without really dealing with it. But emotions are funny things, and if you don't deal with them, they'll deal with you at some point, and sometimes in not a manner that you would choose.
Yeah, I think that was my experience. I mean, I am not necessarily an expert at grief since I didn't get to be the unfaithful spouse. I mean, the hurt spouse. But I know that when my mother died, grief ended up to me feeling a lot like surf. That I would be doing okay, and all of a sudden there would just be this wave that would kind of wash over me, and then things would kind of be okay on the other side, and then suddenly another wave. And I guess part of the problem that the hurt spouse has is that in this reaction stage is there's continually reminders, I guess, that would come and kind of trigger these waves that begin to cause the pain to come back, and then they enter all the way back into that maybe being reactive in the reaction stage, right?
And it's a really good time to be taking sunglasses with you wherever you go, because you can be in the grocery store and a sun can come on. You can be anywhere. You'll hit a thought will hit you. A piece of music will bring back a memory. And the truth is, people at this stage are really, really fragile.
Yeah, and for those of you who've been betrayed, it's almost tragic, but it seems like every song on the radio, every plot on every television show deals with betrayal, and just one thing after the other ends up being sort of a, you know, an intrusive kind of reminder.
So in the reaction stage, then, if someone, the hurt spouse, is really angry and decides to wrap her husband's golf clubs around his bicycle, which part of that reaction stage might that one be? Would that be part of the reaction stage?
That would definitely be the reaction stage. I think in that one, the numbness is worn off. Most certainly, and yes, that's a real story from a real client. The anger is understandable, but we really encourage people to not be destructive with it.
Are there some examples, like at some of the other stages of the reaction thing, just stories you can think of besides just, I'm just trying to think of helping people to re-relate.
Well, and I guess as I kind of alluded to earlier, you know, Rick was talking about one client who was very, very comfortable with her anger and expressing it. But we've had clients who were raised in households where anger was unacceptable. And so they try really hard to be nice Christian people in their reactions to this. But the feelings won't go away, because anger is a secondary emotion. And behind it are almost always hurt, fear, feeling put down, and oftentimes guilt. And so it's really important for you to figure out the feelings behind the anger, because your spouse needs to hear your feelings, but if you're able to share it without the energy of the anger, that's just really ideal.
Yeah, and one thing I'd probably mention too is that these emotions can turn on a dime. I mean, you might be feeling very, very hopeful one minute, and the next minute, you know, ready to wrap the golf clubs around the tree again or around his head or whatever the case may be. And it just, you can be all over the map. It really is an emotional roller coaster, as we say sometimes.
Yeah, and one of the things that's really critical for you is to be able to give yourself the time and the space to grieve, because going through your recovery is a little bit like having a full-time job you never would have applied for and you're not getting paid for. So if there are things that you can get off your plate as you go through this, it's a really good time to prayerfully consider saying no to things that you would have normally said yes to.
You know, another aspect, I'm sure that everybody's really been listening carefully to my explanation of the mission statement at the beginning, where I say it's about hope, support, and recovery, and I'm sure nobody really has. But there really is a reason that we put that in there, and support, to me, is a really important piece of this process for couples. I mean, obviously, if you don't know that there's hope, that other people have been able to walk this path successfully, not only walk this path, but find that they have a much better marriage, then I think it's difficult to want to embark on the process. But the second piece we say, which is support, really has a lot to do with this stage of recovery, which is the reaction stage. Because I think if you don't have other couples who are supporting you, helping contain you, helping hold you, helping keep this whole thing in place, almost like a carbon rod in a nuclear reaction, it's really difficult to do the recovery process. I know that when we went into recovery, gratefully, there was a couple that sat down and talked to us, and his story was very similar to mine. And when Stephanie was able to talk to his wife, there was just something magical almost that happened for her, because she began to see that there was a possibility she had never even hardly considered. And this other woman was able to clearly explain why she had done this. And her support was amazing, because it really helped Stephanie kind of keep the course and keep the hope while we began to go through the recovery process, which wasn't always just a yellow brick road. I mean, at times there was a few bumps, a few potholes, and a few major landmines.
Well, and the kind of support that you seek out is really important. You need somebody that you can be authentic with, but somebody that will also keep God at the center of it and always turn you back to the Lord.
So we're going to be up against a break here pretty soon. So the important components of this task would be?
Well, number one is full disclosure. And as Rick mentioned, you know, sometimes the unfaithful spouse will drag it out, but it's really important to stick with it and get the whole story. And as you're getting the whole story, we do encourage you to do what we call the 24-hour rule, where if you have questions, you write them down, you pray about them for 24 hours, and ask God if this is something you can really handle. And remember, anger is a secondary emotion. Use paper. Use a good friend. Try to figure out the feelings that are going on behind the anger, and try to share them with your spouse without the energy and the destructiveness of your anger.
Good. We'll finish these up later. During the break, actually, we had a question come in. The question that came in during the break was this. Sometimes maybe getting angry and doing something is appropriate. They actually brought up the example of Jesus taking the whip to the money changers in the temple and going kind of crazy. And so, Leslie, what do you think? What does someone do with that anger, and how is anger appropriate?
Well, I really, this is just my personal opinion, is that I think anger is incredibly appropriate, but I think that most people who have experienced infidelity aren't having a self-righteous anger. I mean, they're having more of a self-righteous anger. They're not having kind of a God-righteous anger as they do it. Because also, God says vengeance is His. And so, yeah, the anger is understandable. I just really think it's important that we don't express it destructively.
Yeah, and I think, you know, sometimes the very things that we think we're doing that'll make our anger go away or dissipate it a little bit are actually up in the ante a little bit. I mean, yeah, it might feel really good to get the chainsaw out and cut their car in half, but actually it's probably going to make you more angry while you're doing it.
Yeah, and then you just have to go for something else.
Well, yeah.
A lot of times when we think we're getting the anger out, we're actually ramping it up, and we get a really nice adrenaline rush that goes with it.
Definitely.
Right, and I think another one of the problems that seems to occur with anger, Jesus says that we should be angry but sin not. And I really believe that the whole issue of sin and anger is when we actually are angry with the point of hurting another person, that we're responding in a way that is unloving. And certainly there are ways of being angry and expressing that anger in love. But if we come to the point to where it's unloving, at that point we've just broken Jesus' first command, which is love each other.
And that's hurting the person who's expressing the anger that way, too. It's not just hurting the other person.
Well, and I've had some clients do some very, very creative things with their anger. One in particular goes and buys a stack of plates at Goodwill. And when she's really angry, she throws them against the back of the house, puts them in a little box called God's Promises, and then when she's not so angry, she turns them into mosaics.
Yeah, and we're not suggesting in any way that you don't have a right to be angry or don't need to find a way to express it, because you absolutely do. It's just you want to find a healthy and constructive way that's not going to hurt you or hurt somebody else.
Yeah.
All right.
And before we go on to the third task, I just wanted to say that in the reaction stage, or task that you have to work through, rather, your spouse is going to feel better much sooner than you are. A lot of times, you know, they're relieved that the secret is out. And so it's going to take you much longer than them to feel better. And the other thing that I want to warn you about in this, going through this task, is that you're actually vulnerable to withdrawing. And as Rick was saying, it's really important to reach out to others and not withdraw, because as a person withdraws, they tend to go into themselves, believe a lot of things that aren't true, and just spiral downward pretty quickly.
Yeah, so if it's kind of speaking to the betrayers out there, you want to give your betrayed spouse the time he or she needs to really get over this. Because like Leslie says, yeah, you're probably going to feel a lot better before they do.
Okay, and on to task three.
Task number three is actually release, and this is about getting down to ground zero. So you want to explain that to us?
Yeah, the goal of this task is to let go of the old marriage and to adjust to the reality that former things will never be regained. A lot of times people have trouble letting go of their old dreams, their old marriage, who they thought that person was, and they keep going back trying to breathe new life into it. That's never going to work. You have to get to the point where you're willing to just let the past go down to ground zero, because nothing can be rebuilt until everything's down to ground level. One of the important things in this task is also to commit to forgiveness. A lot of times people are not willing to commit to forgiveness until they feel like the other person has tried hard enough to make up for what they've done, which they're never going to be able to do. Eventually, you, the person who's been hurt by infidelity, for your own good, you're going to have to let go of it and commit to forgiveness. And forgiveness is a process. And so we don't encourage quick, cheap, easy forgiveness. There are a lot of things that the infidelity has cost you. And it's really important to consider what those are, consider the cost, consider how it felt, and then begin to let go of it. A really good definition to remember at this point of forgiveness is letting go of the hope of ever having a better past, because you can't fix the past.
Right, and I think we end up talking about forgiveness every week, and I'm sure you're going to hear us say this particular word over and over again, but the process of forgiveness, while it's a really important piece, how that is done in a couple that's actually dealing with betrayal is really important. I remember a few years ago, we actually were working with a couple who had gone to a very good seminar, marriage seminar, an intensive weekend actually, with the express purpose of trying to heal their marriage after a betrayal. However, one of the aspects of that weekend, which is a very common piece with a lot of marriage intensives, was the topic of forgiveness. And so they were actually trying to really promote forgiveness over that weekend, which in the case of a betrayal is not a good idea, simply because that's a lot, it's a larger process. There were many things that needed to be already dealt with, places where The unfaithful spouse needed to really, I think, assist his mate. And so you don't start with forgiveness necessarily. I think that's one of the reasons the release stage is like number three here in the list of what we're talking about.
It's down the road a bit, and that particular couple, if I'm right, they were only 3 weeks from disclosure. It was really, really rough. She had only just begun to understand what it was she was dealing with.
Yeah, so at that point, if someone says they forgive, they may actually be able to say it, but it's almost going to be impossible for them to emotionally really start feeling that. And so it ends up being sort of a very lukewarm kind of forgiveness. And then sometimes a person feels guilty because they still have the feelings after they said they'd forgiven them.
And a lot of times, well-meaning people, pastors, friends, family members, you know, a few weeks later say, oh, you need to just forgive them already. But really, it's too soon.
Right. I think that it's a thing that you just really have to be willing to let the process play out. A lot of therapists, in fact, I think, make the mistake of trying to push issues like forgiveness very early into the process. And we certainly, as we talk with other therapists, suggest that they hold their horses a bit and let things play out, let the person have their emotions. Obviously, we believe that we are called to forgive in the same way that Jesus forgave. But the feelings are such, until you can even begin to understand, it's hard to know what it is you're forgiving during that process.
Even begin to make sense out of that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so the important goals in this task are to begin to let go of the former relationship. You also need to adjust to the idea of a new relationship that's not based solely on making sure your spouse pays for what they've done. That's part of what you're going to have to let go of. They can be patient, they can be understanding, and these will be helpful, but truly they can never, ever make up for what they've done. One of the most important things in the release task is to begin to trust God with your spouse. It's not so much about trusting your spouse as it is about trusting God with your spouse. And we did talk about it's important to commit to forgive, not to have achieved it, but to commit to it. And I also encourage people to come up with a goal other than saving their marriage. Sometimes people will come up with a goal of using this to draw them closer to God, or using it somehow for personal growth. And also with the hope that God will use this down the road in their lives.
And one of the real privileges of this line of work is we get to kind of see that on a daily basis, how it plays out that way. You know, sometimes we say that God does his most profound work in our broken places. And I know I, for one, couldn't do this for a living if we didn't get to see that sort of miraculous outcome sometimes.
Because the other thing is, the truth is, you probably have a lot of people to forgive besides your spouse. And that's part of this task also. Surely, you know, if there was an affair partner, you have to forgive that person. If there are friends who knew and didn't tell. If there's a mother who was always too involved in the picture, there are a lot of people that you're going to need to forgive as you work on this task. And this task can take quite a while.
Right, and I think the release stage is about more than forgiveness. I know Leslie's already saying that, but we're talking about forgiveness. But the other thing is, I think when you release your mate, you're really saying, I'm going to fear God more than I fear you. One of the things I see all the time is that a hurt spouse will really begin to make their focus, or their mate their focus, and how their mate's doing, and is their mate going to get it right, and is their mate going to be good, and is their mate going to follow program. On and on. And so their peace basically is based on how their mate is doing or not doing. And really, you want to begin to release them from that, because that's about your peace. And if you're not able to do the release stage and let them go, then ultimately you're making them their God. Because as we say, whatever captures your attention ultimately is going to capture you. And if you make them your point of focus, then ultimately you're making them your God. And you do not want the unfaithful spouse to ultimately be your God.
And it's really important to daily release the evaluation of how things are going. Is my spouse doing well today? I made the right decision by staying. Is my spouse not doing well today? I made a bad decision. And then we predict tomorrow's weather based on the weather report today. And that process will just make you crazy, and you really have to let go of that also.
Welcome back to Affair Recovery Radio. And I believe we have a caller on the line at this point. So, whoever the caller is, would you like to go ahead?
Yes. I didn't listen to your first program. I have read some books. In fact, I did get that book that you recommended. No, somebody else, The Affair of the Mind. Anyway, affairs, is it normally sort of out of anger in a form of revenge against the betrayed partner?
If I can jump in, absolutely not. Sometimes it might, but that would actually be the exception, not the rule. Generally, that's a very small percentage of affairs where it would actually be in retribution. Actually, most affairs that happen in retribution are actually the hurt spouse who's really upset because of their mate being unfaithful, and so in retribution and anger, they will have an affair. But what you're talking about is actually the exception. Generally, a person's affair really has nothing to do with their mate at all.
Well, I would think, though, that it was if they were indeed angry at their mate because they weren't getting their needs met, and then someone comes along who's meeting those needs, and it's kind of like a little boy saying, I'll show you, here's somebody who'll take care of my needs.
Actually, it's usually more that they're vulnerable to an affair. It's like, they feel like they're in the desert and there's a glass of water. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that they're trying to hurt their spouse as their motivation. It's more that they're trying to get their own needs met.
Yeah,
but don't they see that they're hurting their spouses? I mean, that's what I don't understand.
Strangely enough, not all the time, not in the moment. And there's the book that you mentioned is certainly a good book. Another good book is Shirley Glass's Not Just Friends.
Yeah, I called the library, and it's on its way to House and Branch, so I can pick that up.
Yeah, because a lot of times they're vulnerable to an affair, but they don't even see it coming necessarily. Somebody shows an interest in them. Somebody says, wow, you look great today, and they just are naturally drawn to it. Doesn't make it right, but it's not that they intentionally mean to go out, have an affair, to hurt their spouse.
Yeah, sometimes they'll try to make themselves the victim to justify the affair. But we generally come from the standpoint that, there's nothing a spouse can do that would make it okay for their partner to have an affair.
Right. Did you have any other question?
Yeah, and I was going to ask if the betrayed spouse, if the mate does not want to reconcile, then does that person go through pretty much the same recovery?
The recovery, I believe, is pretty much the same because, whether the spouse wants to stay in the marriage or not, the betrayed spouse's recovery can't be about their spouse. It really needs to be about their own pain, their own grief, and their own process.
In fact, I would actually say when we're working with a betrayed spouse, our focus isn't to get them to help or to help them fix their mate. That it's the same focus. How do we get our focus back on God and let God kind of be the core of their life so they can have peace regardless of what their mate is doing?
Yeah.
And that's a huge challenge. But I think as people are able to take up that challenge and really pursue God, the challenge of trusting God with this whole process, instead of their spouse, it's beneficial to them.
Yes, yes. Well, is it possible to be married to somebody who's, I'm separated and I think he's having at least an emotional affair but does not really want to divorce or work on the marriage. Is it possible for a person to actually just sort of shelf that person and then just be able to focus just on themselves and their relationship with the Lord?
Are you talking about the unfaithful spouse?
The betrayed spouse.
So would it be possible for you to be able to just kind of not worry about him and get your focus back on God and kind of, or someone in that place who separated kind of be able to have a good life in spite of what their mate's doing?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But still remain married.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I really think the important question for you is, where do you see God in this process? What do you think he's telling you to do?
Yeah, Leslie sometimes says that the only reason to consider staying in a relationship is because God's telling you to. The only reason to consider checking out of a relationship is because God's telling you to.
Because one of the things as you speak of your husband is, you know, whether he's having an emotional affair or a full-blown affair, is he willing to give up this relationship for the marriage?
And actually, I'd even go farther. Is he willing to give up this relationship for God? I mean, ultimately, what's God telling him? And because I wouldn't want someone just beginning to try to come back to a marriage for the sake of saving a marriage. Ultimately, if the marriage is the motivation, I think that the marriage will be enough of a disappointment that will kind of kill their motivation.
But it's hard for you to be the one to convince your husband that he's not following God.
Yeah, I've tried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Understandably so, but...
Well, the thing of it is, we didn't practice any faith in the marriage, so it was the very separation that he went back to the Catholic Church and then I went back to the Christian Church and actually got baptized, which was a huge thing.
What a blessing.
So well,
those are the big things, but it's still hard for me. I mean, since my husband was sort of my cornerstone, is to replace that with Jesus now.
Absolutely.
For, you know, 27 years, I mean, he was the cornerstone.
And absolutely.
So it's such a whole different, it's a world, and it's such a struggle to not think about him and not want to. Sometimes I wake up kind of rehearsing these things I want to say to him, you know, trying to get through to his heart. And it's just kind of a rumination. It just sometimes drives me crazy. It's not all the time, but it's sometimes in the wee hours of the morning.
Well, and I'm so glad that you're choosing to use Christ as your cornerstone, and I encourage you to continue to do that. And none of this is easy, but it's very, very worthwhile. And I remember going through that struggle myself, and I really appreciate you calling in tonight. Thank you so much.
And one of the things...
Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. And one of the things you might enjoy next week is actually we're going to have two hurt wives on the program who will be answering questions about what their process was like. And so if you want to call in and maybe talk with them next week, since that's going to be on the agenda, they may be able to answer some of your questions also.
Well, actually, I've got an appointment with Leslie starting in April.
Oh, well, good. I look forward to meeting you.
Working with you.
Look forward to meeting you face to face.
Call the Hurt Wives next week anyway.
I will. Thank you. Thank you for your program.
Okay.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, our final task tonight is the task of recommitment.
And this task will look very different depending on whether your spouse is still in the marriage or not. But ultimately, it's a recommitment to God. Is it the center of this? A recommitment to God, living life the way He is calling you to, seeing your life differently. As our caller mentioned just now, it's very easy when we're married to make our spouse our cornerstone. But as you're able to make Christ your cornerstone, the recommitment task will be a blessing to you, to those around you, to your kids. And the goals in this task are... A new pledge to the marriage, if your spouse is in the marriage. If not, of course, this won't apply to you. Creating a sense of a new life and who you are in that. Letting God show you how big He truly is and how much He loves you. And this, I think, is the most important goal of your whole recovery, is really grasping how deep and great God's love for you is. And finally, to develop a new sense of purpose in your life.
And I know sometimes in an affair, you can wonder if the sky's ever going to be blue again. But there, you know, you never want to lose sight of hope.
Right. And I think the recommitment, ultimately, I think you need that stake in the sand to know that there is a God. And just to begin to show that there is nothing the nearness of God cannot heal. We're beginning to wind down tonight. I want to thank you for joining us this evening. We will be having some Hurt Spouses on the program with us next week. And so if you have any questions for what it's like for somebody who's already been through recovery, this will be a great time to be able to talk to somebody. We'd invite you to come also visit our website at affairrecovery.com and register for our free newsletter, or you can certainly listen to these radio casts or other podcasts that we have. See, anything else you guys want to say tonight to everybody?
We want to say good night.
God bless.
And then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me?